Among the musicians I work with, I'm notorious for being constitutionally unable to perform whatever set list I've written.
So everybody needs big ears in order to know what's going to be played now or next. Yeah.
Yep.
How much of a teenager is still in you?
Well, according to many people, too much.
Hey und herzlich willkommen zum Elbphilharmonie Talk. Ich bin Julika.
Ich bin Tom.
Und Tom, du hast für diese Folge ja mit dem Gitarristen Marc Ribot gesprochen, beziehungsweise gezoomt, oder?
Ja.
War er bei sich zu Hause?
Er war bei sich zu Hause. Ich habe nur eine schöne Backsteinwand gesehen und das sah alles sehr aufgeräumt aus, aber es war bei ihm zu Hause in Brooklyn.
Eine Brooklyner Backsteinwand.
Genau.
Wie man sich das vorstellt.
Wie man es sich vorstellt. So
sehr
ganz
schön.
Stilecht. Ein Loft vermutlich.
Ribot ist ein legendärer amerikanischer Gitarrist, ist 1954 geboren, das heißt in diesem Jahr auch schon 70 Jahre geworden,
ja.
Was man sich wirklich überhaupt nicht vorstellen kann. Er treibt die New Yorker Jazz-Szene noch immer extrem voran.
Ja.
Wenn man über ihn liest, liest man so verzweifelte Versuche, Jazz, Noise, Rock, Protestsongs, man versucht irgendwie das einzuordnen. Es ist offensichtlich schwer, die richtigen Worte dafür zu finden.
Ja, am besten lässt man das mit der Einordnung auch und sagt einfach, er ist wirklich ein über alle Ufer tretender, überbordender Musiker, der einfach wirklich sehr, sehr viel auf der Pfanne hat. Und trotzdem eben, und das finde ich bei ihm so besonders schön, so verschiedenartig die Projekte sind und auch die Guest Appearances bei anderen Musikern, irgendwie hört man ihn dann schon immer raus. Also er hat einfach diesen ganz starken, unverwechselbaren Charakter. So wie Marc Ribot spielt niemand sonst. Und das schätze ich wahnsinnig hoch.
Hat er verschiedene Gitarren, mit denen er spielt?
Ja, er hat natürlich verschiedene Gitarren. Die sehen, glaube ich, alle ganz schön abgerockt aus. Und er spielt ja bei uns, das erste Konzert wird ein Akustik-Solo-Konzert sein. Und ich glaube, diese Akustikgitarre ist auch ein relativ museales Teil, weil er geht nicht sehr barmherzig um mit seinen Instrumenten. Er hat ein sehr schönes Buch geschrieben, da schreibt er irgendwie so sinngemäß, manche Gitarre habe ich mir zurechtgebogen, aber die Gitarren haben auch mich zurechtgebogen. Es ist wirklich ein Struggle
Beziehung.
Und ein Give and Take und eine ganz symbiotische Verbindung, die er hat zum Instrument.
Du sagst erstes Konzert, vielleicht müssen wir dazu noch kurz erklären, er kommt ja eben als Reflektor-Künstler jetzt Mitte November in die Elbphilharmonie. Reflektor-Festival ist dieses Format, in dem eine große Künstlerpersönlichkeit für ein paar Tage sozusagen den Schlüssel zur Elbphilharmonie bekommt und ein Festival kuratiert. Wir hatten da Angelique Kidjo, Max Richter, Anushka Shankar, jetzt in diesem Frühjahr gerade André Heller. Das heißt ja nicht jedes Mal, dass die auch selber auf der Bühne sind. In diesem Fall ist er ja fast an allen Konzerten beteiligt.
Genau, du hast jetzt interessanterweise all die Leute genannt, die eben gerade dafür stehen, dass sie nicht ständig selbst involviert sind in ihre Aktivitäten beim Reflektor. Und bei Marc Ribot ist es anders. Er ist an fast allem selbst beteiligt. Das ist ein bisschen ähnlich wie bei John Zorn. Der, also, wenn er nicht mitgespielt hat, was oft der Fall war, hat er nicht mitgespielt, aber er hat alle Bands angesagt. Er hat immer auf der Bühne gesessen. Er hat immer sozusagen gewitnessed, was passiert.
Er war extrem präsent.
Er war ultra präsent und der Control Freak, der er nun mal ist. Und da ist ja auch eine enge Beziehung zwischen den beiden. Also er hat ja auch schon mit Zorn hier beim Bagatell-Marathon im März 2017, kurz nach der Eröffnung, hat er hier konzertiert. Und da hat er, wenn ich mich richtig erinnere, großenteils auf der Akustikgitarre gespielt.
Er kommt ja jetzt teilweise auch so mit Bandprojekten, die eine Zeit lang nicht auf der Bühne waren, oder?
Ja, das ist total toll, weil er nämlich mit zwei Bands kommt, von denen ich bei beiden dachte, dass sie eigentlich längst schon verblichen wären. Das war nicht ganz richtig. Das trifft also nur auf die Cubanos Postizos zu, also auf die Fake-Cubaner sozusagen.
Die ja im großen Saal sind.
Die im großen Saal spielen und eben eigentlich, wenn man so will, die kommerziell erfolgreichste, in Anführungszeichen, Musik spielen, die Ribot unter eigenem Namen je gemacht hat, weil da eben auch wirklich kubanische Musiker mitspielen. Und er erzählt im Talk, er war kurz davor, im Grunde nach Kuba zu gehen oder die Option war verlockend. Weil die Musik einfach so stark ist und so eine Anziehungskraft auf ihn ausgeübt hat, von der Rhythmik her und davon, dass man irgendwie mit der Eins ganz anders umgehen muss und so. Musikinterne Dinge, die ihn irrsinnig beschäftigt haben und die ihn aber so weitergebracht haben. Und natürlich ist das Musizieren auf Kuba irgendwie nochmal eine ganz andere in der Gesellschaft verankerte Geschichte, als da in diesem immer etwas randständigen New York seine Frickelmusik zu spielen, wo der Mainstream sich überhaupt nicht drum kümmert und nicht für interessiert und so. Das andere sind die Ruthless Cosmopolitans, auch eine ich möchte mal sagen, glamouröse Band von Marc Ribot, aber die haben offenbar immer mal wieder gespielt, die haben auch immer mal wieder einen Film begleitet. Die waren also nicht so lange weg wie jetzt die Cubanos Postizos, die ja tatsächlich jetzt auf unsere Einladung hin und auf unser Flehen und Drängen und könntest du nicht und es wäre doch schön, wenn, hat er gesagt, na gut, wenn ihr wollt. Und dann hat er natürlich gleich ein paar Gigs dazu sich organisiert, wenn er sie schon mal wieder zusammentrommelt.
Worauf freust du persönlich dich am meisten?
Ich freue mich wirklich sehr auf das Solo-Konzert, also auf den Anfang.
Das übrigens auch gestreamt wird.
Ja, sehr gut, Kanal, sehr gut. Ja, das ist toll. Und das ist ja auch ein Doppelkonzert. Er spielt ja eben erst auf der akustischen Gitarre Solo. Er hat mir ja so halb versprochen im Gespräch, das wir führen, dass er auch ein Stück möglicherweise von seinem Lehrer Franz Casseus, diesem wundervollen Musiker aus Haiti, spielen könnte. Mal sehen. Und dann spielt Ceramic Dog. Und das ist einfach eine total tolle Krawalltruppe. Ich habe ihn dann ja gefragt, so, weil er brüllt da, er singt da mit so einem Megafon und das ist irgendwie so eine, und er spielt so eine Rockgitarre, wie man sie vor 40 Jahren vielleicht gespielt hat, so irgendwas zwischen Sonic Youth und irgendwie Hard Rock, so eine sehr ungenaue Beschreibung. Und dann habe ich gefragt, bist du noch in der Pubertät? Und dann sagt er, ja, wahrscheinlich schon. Und so nach dem Motto, ja, lang lebe die Musikerpubertät, weil er ist einfach, das ist nicht, das denkt er sich nicht aus, sondern das kommt aus ihm genauso raus, wie er es spielt.
Ihr seid ja dann am letzten Tag seines Festivals auch noch gemeinsam auf der Bühne für eine Listening Session, so nennen wir dieses Format, ja. In dem er eben dann, ihr legt zusammen Platten auf, er zeigt ein bisschen, welche Musik er hört, gibt ein paar.
Genau, er hat eine Liste geschickt mit einer wirklich imposanten Reihe.
Ah,
von
du kennst die Liste
ich
schon.
Ich verrate natürlich keinen.
Ich wollte gerade fragen, gibt es Überraschungen?
Nein, Überraschung gibt es natürlich jede Menge und das zeigt dann auch seinen doch sehr eklektischen Musikgeschmack und das, was er alles liebt und wie tief ihn das auch geprägt hat. Und da freue ich mich natürlich sehr, sehr drauf. Wird auch live gestreamt übrigens und kann man dann hinterher angucken.
Den Link packen wir euch in die Shownotes auf jeden Fall. Und damit viel Spaß beim Hören.
Unbedingt.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
So I'm totally excited to be in conversation with Marc Ribot. Marc, you are in Brooklyn right now in your home, is that true?
Brooklyn, New York.
And you just got up, or are you an early bird? Did you rise much earlier?
Yeah, no, I got up much earlier than... Anyways, yeah, I'm up now. That's the main thing.
That's the main thing, yeah. So we're talking basically about the upcoming Reflector Festival of yours in the Elbphilharmonie. And you will certainly... Remember that you've been playing in our hall already twice. There was
I think it was
in March 2017, just a couple of weeks after the whole thing had opened.
That was with Zorn, correct?
That was with Zorn.
Yeah.
Bagatelle's Marathon.
I remember it well.
Yeah, it was wild. It was very wild, you know, and it took many, many hours. And the later it got, the lesser people would stay. But it was, the intensity would just rise, and it was quite something.
Yeah.
And that was with Asmodeus. I think you were playing with.
That's right.
And then about 2 years later, you came with Ceramic Dog. I think with the same lineup that you are going to bring now to Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
The John Zorn that brought you to our place in January 2017. He had his own Reflector Festival just 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. Did he tell you anything about how it was when he came back?
Yeah, we had lunch after that and he said it was great. He loved playing there.
He enjoyed playing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did a wonderful, very focused job over those many days. And in a way, of course, your way of assembling musicians has some resemblance to how Zorn did it, because you just bring the musicians you most love to play with, obviously. And among the, I think, 7 or 8 concerts that you are going to present, there are only 2 where you won't be on stage. Is that correct? Have I put that up correctly?
I think I'm going to be on stage. You know, maybe, I'm sorry, I should have looked at the program before doing this. I've been working very hard on the preparing the music. In fact, if I swivel the computer around, which I'd rather not do, but you'd see that there's charts all over my floor.
Oh boy, yeah.
But I'm like that I'm preparing.
Cool.
I'm going to be a good boy. I'm going to get them copied so that they're easy to read, so that, you know, so that I can actually get everything rehearsed in time for the. But it's been a challenge because with the Rootless Cosmopolitan's Shrek concert in particular, mm-hmm. we're dealing with stuff that I haven't performed in 35 years. I tell you the truth, not only have I not performed it, I don't think I've listened to it. By the time I put something out on a record, I've heard it enough and I don't want to hear it again, you know? So
you're not that kind of musician who would just re-listen to its own stuff?
No. But it's been great to go back to it after all this distance. And what I found when I re-listened to my own stuff from that time period, because there's, you know, the two studio records, and then there's with Shrek, there's the live record mm-hmm. that came out on Avant. What I found that from listening to it, or was it on Sonic? I can't remember. But what I found from listening to it was that some of it I didn't like at all, but some of it I was really impressed with. And, you know, what I realized is that I was doing this stuff at the time, and it was a real compositional direction. And I kind of changed direction because, you know, I don't know, people were...
Not too excited about playing this?
Well, we liked playing it, but people weren't all that excited about hearing it. But now... But now that I listen to it, I realize that I have an idea of how I could do it better, do the material. But I also am very, I feel very happy that I actually like it, and I think I'm going to revive that material and continue to perform it. And I would have never done that if I hadn't had this, if I hadn't been kind of talked into doing it in Hamburg, you know.
Yeah, this is so good because, of course, I'm totally remember Rootless Cosmopolitans and Cubanos Postizos. And I think those are, at least in this side of the pond, among the more, you know, successful, in brackets,
right,
endeavors
exactly.
of yours. And this was, of course, a dream to have this band coming up again. And I know how much reluctance there might have been to say, you know, this is over. I don't want to do this anymore. But then the way you... describe it now, it's even more fascinating to unearth stuff that you've probably totally forgotten and revise and
right.
see what it's all about. So,
well, with Cubanos Postizos, it's been, you know, I reached a certain point at which one can only be postizo for so long, you know, prosthetic. And I reached a certain point at which I said, okay, at this point, it's either time to move down to Cuba and make that my focus really for as long as it takes, or it's time to say that this was a project that I did and I'm very glad I did it, but time to move on to the next thing. So I chose the latter, but we never, you know, the project has, it's kind of been in the freezer, but we thaw it out from time to time. You know, we love to get together and we love to play the material, and you know, that band always had a special feel about it. And so so that I've performed more. I haven't done it in a few years, I believe. No, I did it last year. I did it the year before last at Big Ears Festival. You know, that's how it is. We'll do it a gig and then not see each other for a few years. So that I've performed more recently.
Were you joking when you said you were just thinking about I either go down to Cuba and really go knee deep into it, or were you really tempted to really sacrifice in a way?
Yeah. I was tempted. Yeah, I mean, because it's such a son cubano, is such a deep music, and you know, I'd started to do it partly because it mystified me. Before I started to do that band, half the time, you know, with, you know, Changui stuff, I half the time couldn't figure out where one was. So I wanted to get inside it to learn it, you know, and I wanted to get inside it because it was something that I'd lived next door to, you know, if you live in New York, or at least if you lived where I lived during the 80s, you were hearing a lot of salsa.
kind of ubiquitous and very well played, of course.
Yeah, whether you played it or whether it was on your own record player or not, you heard it through the walls, through the ceiling, in the street, you know. So, yeah, it was something that I wanted to understand better. That's why I did the band. And also because I'd heard the, you know, at that time in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, a lot of new recordings of Cuban music became available in the U.S. Mm-hmm. A lot of them had been on East German labels. And when the wall came down, became available in the U.S. So I was excited about that.
So do you own any of these old Amiga records with Cuban musicians on it?
Yeah, I have a few. There was a record store, I can't remember what it was called, but at the 42nd Street subway station.
Okay, yeah, I think.
That was legendary, and the guy down there turned me on to a couple.
So he got all this import record stuff. And now I assume it's just sitting on the shelf and catching
it's
dust.
It's there somewhere.
So let's talk a bit about the order of things when you come. You will start with a solo concert, obviously, on the Friday night, which is something I'm very much looking forward to. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, would it only be electric guitar, or will you make good use of this beautiful something here, which I show you just is your edition of Franz Casale's classical guitar pieces?
Well, what I mostly perform when I perform solo, it's acoustic. Mm-hmm. But my solo performance, that's one of the things that I've done the most in the last, I would say, 15 years, is solo acoustic guitar performance. And I love doing it. And what I do is whatever comes into my head at that night. But usually, and especially now that you've mentioned that you like it, if I know one person in the audience likes it, I usually do at least a tune or two of Franz Casale's.
Yeah, I confess I'm struggling with the fingering of Jan Valu right now, because I love this piece very much, and I find it has a very particular charm. And you are a great solace of mine, because in your book, I think it's you write that learning guitar is a very slow process, and it takes a long time to really get grips on one bar and then go to the next bar, or however you do it. But it takes time, and it's good to hear that from you.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially, you know, I mean, I started out on classical guitar, as, you know, as if you read that interview, you probably read it. Not because I was any kind of young classical guitar aficionado or protege, but just because I wanted to learn guitar, and my family were friends with Franz Casale's, and I knew him. He would come to all family dinners and things like that. So I'd heard him play from a very young age. In fact, it was probably the first live music I ever heard.
Him playing solo in the living room.
Yeah, exactly. I think he must have been bored, you know, because he would always bring his guitar and practice, you know. But for me, it was fantastic. I would listen to him tuning up, and I was amazed, you know. So yeah, these were pieces I'd heard Franz play from a very early age, and I studied with him just because that's how it was. My family, he must have needed students, so they say, "Oh, you'll study with Franz Casale's," even though I really wanted to sound like Keith Richards. So it took me a while to get to Keith Richards. But what you're saying, and what I wrote in the book, pertain to a lot to classical guitar playing, which is that, I mean, the bad news is it takes a while to learn these pieces, especially when you're starting. But the good news is that you learn that if you take a while, that with a certain kind of patience, you can do things that you never imagined you could do.
Would have thought
you have
of
the patience
being able to. Yeah.
You learn a certain kind of patience.
Yeah. Let's talk a little more about Franz Casale's, because he was... I didn't know him before. You know, when I got into your book, into your life, into your recordings, I realized soon enough that you were really linked to him. And he came from Haiti, and he lived in New York. And he was, of course, terribly underrated and not paid for what he had created, this music. And he was, also for people who don't know him, who are listening to our conversation, he was, I think he had this ambition to be something like the Eto Villa-Lobos or something of the Haitian music, blending exactly. it somehow with the classical. And I think he did that in a very beautiful and remarkable way. And you,
yes.
you were editing this as a sheet music, made it available to people in a way, which is, I think, a lovely recognition of your teacher.
Well, some of it had been released as sheet music before,
mm-hmm.
but the thing is, it was in different publishers in different places. Some of it was really badly published. So what we did, my mother, as I said, he was a friend of the family, and mm-hmm. my mother helped him later in his life. My mother helped him get his publishing together all in one place, you know, in these books that hadn't been in print for years or weren't being distributed. And so she assembled the publishing all in one place. That's what enabled it to come out as one book that you mm-hmm. see all the instrumental pieces in one book. So, yeah, Franz was born in Haiti in, I think, 1922 or something like mm-hmm. that. And, yes, it was his ambition to create a classical guitar repertoire of Haitian music. I think Villa-Lobos was a big inspiration for him. He wanted to be, for Haiti, what Villa-Lobos had been for Brazil or mm-hmm. what Bartok had been for Hungary.
Yeah.
And he succeeded in that. He's known in Haiti as the father of Haitian classical guitar. Mm-hmm. And Haitians who are in the cultural scene in Haiti are still aware of Franz's music. I mean, there was a certain point in the 80s when even like guitarists from compas bands, you know, like Haitian pop bands, knew Franz's music and all would play. Even if they were electric guitars, all would have a classical guitar, nylon string guitar somewhere and know a few of the tunes.
Oh.
In fact, they became so well known that some Haitians believed that they were Haitian folk material, even though they were composed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a self-conscious choice to be influenced by Haitian rhythms. He was of the generation that was influenced, of Haitian artists and musicians of all types who were influenced by Aimé César's Negritude movement,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, was a kind of anti-colonial movement, which said that people in the formerly colonized countries should look to their own culture for inspiration. Mm-hmm. And it seems so obvious now, it seems to go without saying. But the truth is that in the 20s and, you know, and before that, musicians in Haiti were trying to pay attention to whatever was happening in France. That's what it meant to be cultured. So it was a radical departure for Franz and the other artists of his generation to say, no, we're gonna go there's plenty going on here to use as material.
Yeah, that's also the method, so to speak, that Nadia Boulanger would use, you know, when Astor Piazzolla and all these people came to her to Paris and wanted to study European music, and she kept sending them back and saying, listen to your own wonderful Argentinian music and dig from there and work with that material. So,
right,
you know, it came from her too. Let's go back to the concerts that you are going to present. Then after your solo opening, so to speak, on Friday night, there will be Ceramic Dog coming, a long-term band of yours, a trio, like you would love to play in mm-hmm. trios, obviously. And this is quite a wild and sometimes tender music, but basically it's quite wild. Something between, I don't know, Hendrix revived and punk and all this, you know, kind of airy, brutal energy that you are bringing on stage. And it's very musical at the same time, and it's wonderful to listen to. And I'm asking myself, and I'm asking you now, has it become more difficult to maintain the physical energy that's maybe needed to play this music with the
needed stamina and conviction than it was in earlier days? Or is there no difference for you because it's electric and you just give the power that the amps have?
Well, it's a little more difficult to do it 14 nights in a row. But that was difficult back then too, you know.
I reckon.
So, yeah. But I like to rock the house, you know. That hasn't changed since I've been a teenager. I mean, the greatest moment for me, what I value more than any possible review or anything else, is when I see people get up and dance, like in the back of the theater or in their seats. When I see people grooving, that's how I know we're doing it right. And that's my favorite response. And there was a certain point a couple of years ago when I realized that the people in Ceramic Dog, that was my longest term relationship, which is kind of sad in a way, but it's also kind of happy, you know, because we just like hanging out and playing. And
we're talking about Shahzad Ismaili, the bass player, and
Chess Smith, the drummer. And that band, it is a rock band. And the reason it came together, it was a post kind of 9-1-1 phenomena. Like, even though the band didn't start for a few years after that. But what I thought about is that, okay, I've been going around doing new music composition projects that are really rock bands, Cuban music projects that are really rock bands, all kinds of projects that are really rock bands. Time to do a rock band, you know? And so Ceramic Dog is a rock band that has been through that and goes through all of everywhere I've been and everywhere that Chess and Shahzad have been. But it's a rock band, and that's that. I'm very happy with our last recording.
Connection.
So, yeah, Connection. I think it's the best work we've ever done. So far from getting tired of doing that, it's like we got better at it, you know?
Yeah, there's good vocals on it too, which is probably needed to make it not too much like a nerdy guitar thing. It's songs in a way. It's very direct.
Definitely songs. Although live, the band can go into improvising, free improvise. The band can go a lot of places live. So we never know where it's going to go. Among the musicians I work with, I'm notorious for being constitutionally unable to perform whatever set list I've written. Those are on the rare occasions that I bother to write them.
So everybody needs big ears in order to know what's going to be played now or next. Yeah.
Yep.
How much of a teenager is still in you?
Well, according to many people, too much.
Which is, in my personal opinion, absolutely wonderful, because it's great to have this age still alive and the hunger for and the rebellious spirit and all this and having it going with it. Are you dancing yourself because you enjoy so much see people standing up in your concerts and dance?
Well, no, I normally, you know, I mean, I'm very self-conscious about this because I know, you know, Duke Ellington, I believe, said, "I've never met a musician of any value who wasn't also an excellent dancer." Well, I never met Duke personally. I hope if we had jammed, I would be an exception that proved the rule. But otherwise, I guess if the dance shoe doesn't fit, don't wear it. Or
don't wear it.
Sorry, I'm making a bad joke. But I'm not much of a dancer. And a long time ago, I started around the time of the Cubanos Postizos. I thought, if Arsenio Rodriguez and Segovia can sit down when they play, they're pretty good. So can I, you know. Because I get very into it, and I'm always afraid if I fall off the chair, it's not as far down as if I fall from a standing position.
I see.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's just a terribly infectious dancey music. All this Cuban stuff. I mean,
well, I dance
it's hard
around
to sit still, you know.
You dance around.
Yeah, yeah.
I dance around in my way, you know.
What I find interesting is more maybe like a fun fact also for you. Ceramic Dog actually performed in this fashion show just a year ago, I think, for Gucci. And do you ever wear any of that stuff, or did they reward you with any Gucci suits? And are you now proud wearer of some of that stuff?
Yeah, I save it for special occasions. I wear the sneakers though all the time, and that's been great. I love.
Are they good?
Well, here I have them. Show here. Me. Hold on a second. Let me see what I did with this.
Cool.
Look, there's some. Oh, hold on. See. Here's my
beautiful.
Here's my Keith Haring design sneakers.
So do you wear them on stage, or must that be even
oh,
more
yes,
elevated?
Yes. Yeah. Cool. No. And I tell you, when you wear cool sneakers like this, you become aware of a whole demographic of society that are into cool sneakers, and it's not at all who you'd suspect. I mean, Basically getting these for free were the only ways I was going to get Gucci sneakers. I mean, they're expensive, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm pointing at, yeah.
So you would think that like only rich people would be aware of them, but that's not the case at all. Some guy will be lying in the street and saying, love those 2019 Keith Haring design
this is so
sneakers,
New York,
you know?
Being generous enough to still say something positive about shoes if you're not in a position to own them. Yeah, cool. Yeah, but I mean, there are little snippets of it that you can watch online on YouTube, I think. And it's a beautiful contrast, of course, your music, and it's rather slow songs. How was that?
You know, like my first response to like the Gucci thing was, I don't know, maybe I'm violating some NDA, but I don't care. My first response, you know, like my manager called me up and said, well, Gucci wants to do something. And my first response was, what do they think I am? Some musical prostitute who will, you know, just perform for any capitalist venture, or, you know, I gave some response like that. Anyways, then she told me a little more about it and we warmed to the idea. And it wound up being terrifically fun. And it was great hanging out with all these, like after it was over, like all the world famous, it was a men's fashion show. So it was all male models. So after it was over, all like the male models, they're all in rock bands and they all wanted to know what pedals I was using. It was really pretty hilarious.
So were they happy to finally have some music that was theirs to walk to?
I think they dug it, you know. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Yeah. A good time was had by all.
Cool. Then you will play with your quartet with James Brandon Lewis the next day. It'll be a double feature. Mm-hmm. Wonderful saxophone player.
And I believe my quartet is also actually going to be a quintet. And I don't want to misspeak.
After the quartet has played, there will be the Red Lily quintet playing again with Jane Brandon Lewis, but then it will be Kirk Nofke on trumpet and Tomeka Reed will play and Sylvia Bolognese.
Oh, okay,
Lily Glick Finnegan.
Right. That's a separate, that was curated.
Yeah, that's a double bill, I think.
Right, yeah, double bill. But I think, I don't want to misspeak, but, well, for some of those gigs, and I thought it was that, we had a late edition of Eva Mendoza.
You will have Eva Mendoza in the Rootless Cosmopolitans just at the ending.
In the Rootless Cosmopolitans. Yeah. Okay, not with the quartet. Okay, I'm getting, I have to get my instrumentations correct then.
Yeah.
We did some of the quartet, we did some quartet performance with Mary Halverson and with James Brandon Lewis. So I just came off a tour of that, so.
Yeah, and you will have Thumbscrew with Mary Halverson also playing in our hall with Mike Formanek on bass and Tomas Fujiwara. Yeah. So
So the quartet, anyways, the band, that material with James Brandon Lewis is kind of my most recent project. And yeah, it was written specifically for that quartet. And we had big plans to get a record out before this, but I've been a little slow getting stuff together. So it won't be, but
you will record
coming
it.
Soon.
Yeah,
coming
cool. soon. Is Hilliard Green going to be on this record then?
Yes,
too?
Because he is. And what this band came out of was, you know, for something like 15 years, I worked with Chad Taylor and Henry Grimes, and initially the trumpet player, Roy Campbell Jr. Well, Roy died at some point during that, and Henry and Chad and I continued as a trio. And during that period, especially towards the end of it, it was like really transcendent. It was the best music I ever played before or since.
With Henry Grimes on bass.
Yeah, not long after the gig, I'm thinking about a series of concerts in Italy. Henry just became too, he was quite old and he became too ill to play. And then he died a few years after that. So I missed playing with that trio very much. And I'd been thinking all the, since that time, since I guess 2000, I've been thinking of, or 2019, I've been thinking of how to continue the project with Chad Taylor. Mm-hmm. Chad is really a remarkable drummer. He's great in his own right, but he's also psychic with me. He knows what I'm going to play before I play it. So yeah, I wanted, well, there's a great connection, and this is the solution we found. Hilliard had also been a friend of Henry's and has been a bass player on the scene working with a lot of great musicians for forever. But I got the idea of using him at for this project we played a memorial for Henry and Henry's wife, Margaret, last year. Mm-hmm. Their daughters, you know, helped put it together and we played at it. And it was fun playing, you know, at the memorial. So I asked Hilliard to perform with this. And James Brandon Lewis, I'd been listening to him for years at Visions Festival. Mm-hmm. And then he'd performed on a couple of tracks when I'd recorded the Songs of Resistance record in, what was that, 2019?
Yeah,
it came out in 19. And I realized as soon as I heard James Brandon's playing, this guy has got it. He's got it going on. He's a real inheritor of the Coltrane tradition, not just in, a lot of saxophonists imitate the style or the notes. And James isn't imitating. He's lived in it and developed his own approach. But James has the sound.
Yes, the sound. And he's gotten the blessing of Sonny Rollins, who says, you know, when I listen to you, I listen to the deeper meaning of life. I mean, what better can you hear as a musician,
yeah.
I would say.
No, there's a certain...
Especially as a young musician.
There's a certain gravitas in James's playing that... There's a certain duende in James's playing that's... Other than getting people up and dancing, this is pretty much all I care about.
Cool. That's an interesting juxtaposition, because I think your reflector maybe lives and feeds off of those two poles in a way, because you bring some of these carriers, bearers of the tradition that has a really meaning. And Hilliard Green, he has played with Cecil Taylor and with Don Pullen and has all this wonderful history in this free improvised music. And on the other hand, there is this high rocky energy side of yours coming, and then the Cubanos Postizos revived or relived, and the Rootless Cosmopolitans. I think it's a really nice packaging of what you've been into in those last years and are into right now, obviously.
Yep. And now all I got to do is rehearse all these bands.
All these bands, yeah. I mean, coming with musicians, there's one double bass player from Italy coming and joining you. You will be playing with Afa Mendoza, with this guitar player who is a bit alike you, I think, in this approach of sonic textures and the variety of styles that she's able, capable of playing. So it's quite an exciting adventure you are up to, right?
I'm excited about it. Yeah. You know,
are these invitations coming more often in the past to you, in addition to all the jazz stuff that you are still playing and venues? And when I see your calendar, you perform all the time, more or less. And I so wish for you for bigger concert halls to say now it's really time to have this carte blanche kind of situation that we are.
Well, maybe if I do a good job here, the other ones won't be afraid of me.
Are they, you think?
Don't start any fires, you know, show up and all that. Yeah.
On time.
Who knows, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, being a musician in my situation, it's really, you have to develop an attitude, the skills of, do you know the book Gulliver's Travels?
Mm-hmm.
It's a story of a man who's journeying around, and one day he's a giant in the land of the tiny people, and
he gets
the next day he's a tiny person in the land of the giants. Well, you have to develop those kind of expectations if you're a musician, at least in my situation, because, you know, I mean, last weekend I did two concerts, and one was at Zankel Hall in Saratoga, which is really a top-rated classical room. And I was doing live music with the Charlie Chaplin film.
Cool.
And very well treated, you know, picked me up in a limousine. It was a beautiful hall. Everything was great. And then the next night, I don't want to talk about where, because, okay, you know,
mm-hmm.
It was a place in New Jersey. And there I am saying, listen, I ain't going to play unless you turn off the beer cooler. So, but you got to just roll with it.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky to have come up at the time I came up and worked with the people I worked with. And I think young musicians now have a much more difficult time. I came up in a time when record companies actually gave even nutcases like me record budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So younger musicians have a hard row to hoe at this point. And I'm happy to still be doing it. I'm at a point where I'm able to try to work with some new musicians, but also really enjoy friends who I've been working with for mm-hmm. decades. So I have nothing bad to say for a change.
So you're, maybe one could say you're like a privileged outlaw, something like that, you know, still being...
Yeah.
Swimming against the stream in a way, but in a beautiful way. And you say it so nicely. I mean, you're really, you go with the flow in a way, and you shift your shape depending on where you are and adjust and still keep your quality standards high. It's fantastic.
Do my best.
So we are very much looking forward to those days in mid-November with you, Mark, and I really thank you for the time you dedicated to talking to me.
Thank you. Looking forward.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.